Hello and welcome to episode 99 of Pay-Per-View, in which I review newspaper articles and current events, placing them into their true context. And the first subject this episode is smart meters. This is in the Telegraph. Customers left with shock bills as 4 million smart meters go dumb. Households are being hit with shock energy bills as 4 million smart meters are not working properly. The number of dumb smart meters is up from a previous estimate of 2.7 million following revisions to official statistics released by the Department for Energy Security and Net Zero published. Bill payers have complained of feeling terrified by the devices after receiving shock meter readings, putting them thousands of pounds in debt. Lord Callanan, the Minister for Energy Efficiency and Green Finance, said he was deeply concerned about the figures in a letter to the Energy Watchdog. He called on Ofgem to enforce legal requirements for suppliers to ensure that smart meters are working properly. He said the scale of some suppliers' underperformance in optimising their operation metering estate over a period of time shows these steps may not have been taken universally, adding, "I am deeply concerned about this." The article continues, broken smart meters do not provide consumers with an accurate reflection of how much energy they have used and can lead to incorrect charges appearing on plug-in displays. Problems with smart meters have affected high-profile consumers. In December, artist Grayson Perry complained of a £39,000 bill he received on a smart meter. In the same month, broadcaster John Sappel revealed his device handed him a £19,274 bill. Estimates by the National Audit Office put the number of faulty smart meters in Britain at just under 3 million last June. DESNZ has now said that the actual figure in June was 4.31 million, far higher than reported at the time. It estimates the current number of faulty smart meters is also higher than the old estimate, though down slightly on its revised figure at 3.98 million. The revisions to the statistics come after corrections were made to data from a minority of suppliers, a final quarter report published by the department showed. It comes as the government's controversial net zero rollout of smart meters balloons over budget and continues to be plagued by problems. The installation scheme, which was supposed to have seen a smart meter installed in every home by 2020, is now forecast to cost more than £13.5 billion. The Energy Watchdog said it was mulling abolishing the energy price cap, currently £1,690 a year for a typical household, and using smart meters to implement dynamic pricing for energy, a move that would go against ministers' prior assurances. In 2018, government guidance said it was a myth that suppliers would charge higher prices through smart meters. It said energy suppliers can only charge prices customers have agreed to, and that won't change. Customers with smart meters can access tariffs that allow them to get cheaper prices at times when demand is low, but it will always be the customer's choice. The article continues, it is thought that many broken smart meters are dumb first generation models that ceased functioning after consumers switched to different suppliers, the NAO said last year. Suppliers are legally required to fix or replace broken smart meters for free under a scheme put in place by Ofgem last month. The devices previously only had a 1 year warranty. Energy companies will now have to play catch-up with millions of faulty smart meters that have ceased working in smart mode and potentially left consumers with incorrect bills. Peter Butler, 97, who lives near Tunbridge Wells, said she had been through 2 years of hell dealing with issues with her meter. It's affected my health and it's completely taken away any confidence I've got. If I have to do anything, I just panic, she told the BBC. Her problems began when she switched to a smart meter with a single tariff in 2022. The device was not installed properly and she received a shock bill of £3,500 between January and June last year, she said. I don't sleep at night because my body, it can't let go, she told the broadcaster, adding she was terrified to use electricity as a result. A government spokesman said smart meters are helping consumers manage their energy use and save money while driving the transition to a smarter and more flexible energy system. Looks like it. The statement continues, the vast majority of smart meters are working correctly. However, we are concerned that reporting errors by a minority of suppliers have uncovered more meters not operating in smart mode than previously thought. Lord Callanan has today written to Ofgem urging action to ensure suppliers are held to account if they are not supporting customers with issues as they should. Well, another point about smart meters that needs to be made that's not made in the article, as I talk about in episode 88, and I've talked about even before that, the health consequences of smart meters and how they can be used to manipulate perception. They are a fundamental part of the technological dystopia being built all around us. And I'll come back to the technological grid that they're planned to be part of later when I give my analysis. And the next subject of this episode is business. This is in The Guardian. Tesco accused of using cash and carry to squeeze Village stores out of business. Village stores have sounded the alarm over what they claim is a battle for survival, accusing the supermarket group Tesco of using its cash and carry arm to squeeze them out of business by restricting supplies and deliveries of groceries. Independent retailers, many of them also running the local post office, have told The Guardian that a series of changes recently introduced by Tesco's wholesale arm, Booker, were adding to pressures at a time when some villages had been left with just one small shop or none at all. They claim Booker has reduced the range of items available by up to 30% at some sites, withdrawn customer favourites at some sites, including Yorkshire tea, Roundtree sweets and Coleman's mustard, reduced the availability and reliability of deliveries. Andrew Goodacre, the chief executive of the British Independent Retailers Association, called on the UK competition watchdog to examine the issue and said he would raise the matter with Kevin Hollinrate, the Minister for Small Business. "I think it's shocking," Goodacre said, "of the problems reported by small retailers. This shows the worst of a large company buying little shops. Communities want these small shops, and these are not businesses making millions of pounds." The article continues, 7 years ago, the competition watchdog took a much criticised decision to wave through the acquisition of Booker, the country's biggest grocery wholesaler, by Tesco, its biggest supermarket chain. Via Booker, Tesco also controls the Londis, Budgens and Premier groups, which are made up of thousands of independent stores tied into buying deals with the wholesaler. In 2017, at the time of the Booker takeover, rival wholesalers wrote to the Competition and Markets Authority, warning it would hand Tesco incontestable power over the procurement of all grocery categories in the UK. Jonathan Cobb, who runs the Village Shop and Post Office in Miserden, Gloucestershire, said it felt like the fears raised then were now a reality. His local Booker had stopped selling sought-after brands including Coleman's Mustard, Tuck and Cheddar Biscuits. The alternatives provided are often branded with the Jack's label supplied by Booker, which is packaging displaying the catchline, part of the Tesco family. Cobb said he did not wish to sell Jack's products as it says Tesco on it. "As much as 30% of the range you previously bought from Booker could no longer be sourced," said Cobb, "and it felt like Tesco was slowly pushing us aside. You cannot order enough for a delivery, as there is now nowhere to store these goods in his small shop." He also wants to continue supporting local farms by buying fresh meat, fruit and vegetables from them, and does not want to be solely reliant on one wholesaler. The Guardian interviewed five small retailers and was shown comments by others from online forums. Shop owners agreed that as much as 20 to 30% of the lines they usually bought from Booker had been affected. A wider number of items can be sourced from Booker if a retailer requests delivery. However, many small stores, which may only make sales of £1,400 a week, cannot reach the £1,200 a week minimum order. One Village shop owner said she did order enough to get deliveries, spending about £1,500 a week, but she said Booker now charged £40 for delivery and had reduced its range by a significant amount, so that she was having to try to find alternative sources of supply. She added that she was no longer able to order just the one or two packs of frozen chips and fish fingers she needed because Booker now demanded a minimum of a whole case and there was not space in her freezer. She said she had spent hours searching for alternative sources of supply, but most were too far away or required additional work, such as inputting every item into the till system by hand, whereas Booker provides the information electronically for a quick download. She said she felt like Booker was deliberately trying to squeeze us out of the market so everybody has to go to the big Tesco. "It's not going to put me out of big business," she added, "but I'm going to lose customers and that will make everything harder. If they carry on the policy, it could just be a matter of years before I go out of business." Another Village shop owner said, "Since Tesco have taken Booker over, it has got harder and harder to get products for the shop. Only 2 weeks ago, they discontinued 400 retail lines." She said her local Booker would not provide a delivery as she was not a catering business, for which the minimum order the wholesaler requires is £150. "Our local pub has a delivery nearly every week. They only have to spend about £100 with no delivery charge. The lorry goes right past the shop," she added. One industry insider said the changes were hitting the smallest Village stores the hardest, particularly those in rural areas that might have little choice of wholesalers. The well-placed source said, "Tesco wants to move into the catering trade and that is its main objective. There has been a lot of increase in catering stock and in order to make space for that it has reduced retail stock." He added that Booker had recently bought larger delivery lorries that struggled to access small country lanes and this had also meant cutbacks to delivery rounds. Booker has said it is not aiming to increase its catering market share at the expense of its retail trade and recently invested in a distribution centre to grow retail capacity. It confirmed it did not deliver to some rural areas in the southwest but said that had not been changed recently. Retailers that could get deliveries said they were no longer seen as a priority and so could find deliveries delayed at the last minute. It's becoming harder to get a delivery, the well-placed industry source said. There's an imbalance of power between local shops and a large supplier. The article continues, Booker announced in February it would be tightening up its range for retailers, which it said had become a little bloated, according to a report in the trade journal Better Retailing. The wholesaler said it would also be introducing more Jack's Own label and more fresh produce after reviewing 151 different grocery categories last year. It promised to respect regional and local lines. Sheila Gallagher, Booker's commercial director, said the changes would make the wholesaler's range more effective with better efficiencies. A spokesperson for Booker said, "We remain absolutely committed to serving community shops across the UK, either through branch or delivery. Last year, we reviewed our range across all branded and own brand products to ensure we have the right offer, and in response to feedback that customers want more consistency across branches. As part of that review, we removed products that customers weren't choosing to make more space for products that really matter. Overall feedback has been positive and we've already seen improvements in availability." And the next subject of this episode is furlough. This is in the Telegraph. Furlough did not save millions of jobs. Its true costs are only now becoming clear. The latest Rishi Sunak advert paints him as quite the hero. 14 million jobs saved, it declares in Hollywood poster style. And underneath, furlough announced 4 years ago today. Super Sunak is shown in three action man guises, at his desk in trademark hoodie, then walking with a look of urgent purpose, finally wearing a face mask, tie tucked into his shirt, ready to save a life or two. Saving a life from a virus that has never been proven to exist. The article continues, it recalls happier times when he was more popular than Churchill, hailed as a financial miracle worker who had saved the country from the worst economic impact of COVID. At the time, the real-life Sunak was nowhere near as confident. He didn't sleep the night before furlough launched, feeling physically sick at the sheer scale of his gamble. It would pay 80% of employees' wages. Might such generosity end up creating welfare dependency, making things worse long-term? Would it just prop up jobs that were never coming back, spending a fortune to delay economic rejuvenation? The test, as he knew, would come years later. In the end, Britain has turned out to be one of the few countries in the world whose workforce is still smaller than it was before the pandemic. Furlough was a powerful drug initially designed for 3 months. It ended up being used on and off for a year and a half, with £70 billion given to 11.7 million people. Companies, not all of which actually existed, were helped with loans. That was the short-term cost. We're only now starting to see the longer-term effect. So it's nonsense to say, as the Conservatives are now doing, that Sunak saved 14 million jobs. Most who took furlough would have been safe anyway, as we saw from places without such a safety net. Yes, far more jobs would have been lost, at least for a while, but an even greater number would have probably come back later and at better salary levels. This has been the experience of the United States, whose economy is now roaring. What struck me in my small magazine is that we got the money whether we needed it or not. We feared the worst for furloughing receptionists and events organisers, but the Spectator boomed as those locked down brought in entertainment. It was springtime for Netflix subscriptions, Peloton bikes, lockdown kittens and sourdough starter kits. It felt unseemly to add taxpayer subsidy on top of this windfall, so we said we'd return it to the Treasury. We were told by an incredulous HMRC that there was no means of doing so. Only when we threatened to leave it in a swag bag outside the Treasury did they relent. Would it have been so hard to deny furlough cash to companies who, in all honesty, did not need it? We saw here a new reflex. When ministers panic, they splurge. Companies and even the rich now expect to be bailed out. In the energy price crisis, Liz Truss subsidised everyone's bill, so taxpayers ended up helping billionaires heat their swimming pools. From the crash onwards, the list of things that the public expect protection from has grown, and with it, the size of the state and tax burden. The risk is that this makes everyone poorer. When the Bank for International Settlements looked around the world, it found employment recovering more slowly where pandemic-related fiscal support was larger. Intriguingly, it also diagnosed an apparent change in the attitude towards work and the way we think about work in the labour market. In other words, people seem more keen to work in places where COVID-era unemployment was higher. This is and can only be a theory. It's impossible to prove an attitude or a mindset, but we do know that in Britain, lockdown soon gave way to a worker shortage crisis. But bizarrely, at the same time, worklessness in our great cities was comparable to the 2008 crash or 1992 recession. In Blackpool, official figures show 25% on out-of-work benefits, in Middlesbrough 22%, Liverpool 20%. With these cities teeming with jobs, the worklessness is an economic and social scandal. It's wrong to blame furlough, but it certainly is a contributing factor. The longer you stay out of work, the more reluctant you are to return to it. This is a basic fact of economic life. It helps explain why over 50s left the workforce in such numbers. But the real problem is one that stayed that started a year before furlough began. People saying they're too sick to work. 5 years ago, 2 million were in this category. Now it's 2.7 million. That's the equivalent to losing the working age population of Birmingham, our second city. This is quite simply a calamity. No economy can prosper while casting aside the skills of so many millions. No other country has it quite so bad. If Britain's post-COVID workforce had recovered at the speed of Germany's, we'd have 1.3 million more in work now, and the recent recession would not have happened. Keeping up with France would have meant 1.2 million more in work, Japan 1.1 million. Sunak's big mistake was thinking that because the new universal credit system had moved record numbers into work, it could do so again. He didn't see, no one did, that mental health complaints had started to discombobulate the entire system. Mel Stride, the working pension secretary, recently told this newspaper how it works or doesn't. If they go to the doctor and say, I'm feeling rather down and bluesy, the doctor will give them on average about 7 minutes. And then on 94% of occasions, they will be signed off as not fit to carry out any work whatsoever. The Prime Minister still tells friends that he will always be remembered for furlough, for better or worse. The triumphalist Conservative Party average don't reflect his own mixed feelings. It's easy to see why party spinners are invoking the days when he was the toast of the nation, but he always saw that as illusory. Let's see how these polls look when they get the bill for all this, he told aides back then. He was, as so often, right first time. And the final subject of this episode is Kate Middleton's disappearance. This is in The Telegraph. China and Russia spreading slurs against Princess of Wales. China, Russia and Iran are fueling disinformation about the Princess of Wales to destabilise the nation, Whitehall sources believe. Senior government figures fear that hostile states are behind the spread of wild conspiracy theories and online rumours surrounding the Princess's health. After the Princess announced her cancer diagnosis, Rishi Sunak led the condemnation of social media trolls for targeting her online. But his intervention did not deter further frenzied commentary, with the disinformation chief saying that the princess had been re-victimised by trolls criticising her for not publicly revealing her diagnosis sooner. It emerged that there was growing concern in Whitehall that hostile state actors could be involved in whipping up the frenzied social media attacks on the princess, a government source told The Telegraph. Part of the modus operandi of hostile states is to destabilise things, whether that is undermining the legitimacy of our elections or other institutions. The article continues. It comes as Downing Street is preparing to announce fresh sanctions on China after a wave of state-backed cyber attacks against a group of senior MPs and peers. The threat of Chinese state interference in British democracy will be raised in Parliament by Oliver Dowden, the Deputy Prime Minister. He is expected to say China was behind a hack on the Electoral Commission last year, during which the personal details of 40 million voters were accessed. Meanwhile, Alison Giles, Parliament's Director of Security, will brief a group of MPs on the heightened threats they face as a result of their hawkish stance on China. The first UK sanctions against Chinese government officials were announced in 2021 for systematic human rights violations against Uyghurs and other minority groups. Last month, Britain issued a wave of sanctions against Chinese companies accused of aiding Russia's war in Ukraine. A task force launched by the government last year aimed at protecting the democratic integrity of the UK from threats of foreign interference is currently looking at a range of ways to tackle the spread of disinformation and conspiracy theories online. The Defending Democracy Task Force, which is chaired by Tom Tugendhat, the security minister, and includes members. The Defending Democracy Task Force, which is chaired by Tom Tugendhat, the Security Minister, and includes members of the Security Services as well as Home Office and Science Department officials, focuses on the role of rogue state actors in spreading disinformation. Countering this is right at the heart of the work of the task force, a government source said. One area under consideration is boosting the role of fact-checking organisations, but officials are wary that this could lead to a new set of controversies. BBC Verify recently came under fire for using an anti-Israel journalist bankrolled by Iran as a key source in its reporting on the Gaza conflict. Another option being studied by the task force is whether social media companies can contain the speed at which disinformation is shared on their platforms. Imran Ahmed, chief executive of the Centre for Countering Digital Hate, said the frenzied social media attacks had done damage to the royal family. When you've got a young lady, the Princess of Wales, who has suffered a medical emergency, you see people flooding in with conspiracy theories. You see them being amplified on social media platforms and pushed to millions and millions of people, he told the BBC Sunday with Laura Quensburg. What really, I think, annoyed me was seeing that she was then being re-victimized by being blamed for not having come out immediately. I think it's the inhumanity of the way that social media has made us behave, forcing people to talk about things that can be very deeply personal. And also seeing, of course, the impact of that on our society, how quickly it was picked up by millions of people, and how much it's done damage to the royal family themselves. The article continues, palace sources say the current challenges facing the royal family, in which both the king and princess are off public duty as they undergo treatment for cancer, are a temporary blip rather than a seismic change. They added that the king was very positive and was building towards a return to public work in the summer, health permitting. Palace sources have spoken of hopes that the social media giants might use the fury to tighten up systems that currently allow defamatory lies and conspiracy theories to spread unchecked. Both the Prince of Wales and his brother, the Duke of Sussex, have urged tech companies to do more to rein in the spread of disinformation and hate speech online. Lord Cameron, the Foreign Secretary, has previously warned that Britain will not tolerate the escalation of Iran's malign activities in the Middle East or on UK soil. He described Hamas, the Houthis and Hezbollah as proxies for Iran who were contributing to an extremely high level of danger and insecurity around the world. A government spokesman said, "The government has regular and ongoing dialogue with social media companies to discuss a range of issues, including disinformation. We are also working across government to ensure we are ready to respond to threats, including through our Defending Democracy Task Force. When fully implemented under the Online Safety Act, platforms will be required to swiftly remove illegal misinformation and disinformation as soon as they become aware of it." Well, it's very possible the Kate Middleton story will be used to push for more regulation of online speech and information. In other words, censorship. So what's the connection between these subjects? Well, I've said for over a decade now that the plan is an end to all business except for giant cult-owned corporations running and producing everything. Amazon already has a research and development facility operated by 5 humans currently and 5,000 robots. AI automation will replace humans in the workplace. Well, that's the agenda anyway. Government spending during the COVID era on rescue packages, furlough and advertising are estimated to have cost the UK government alone in the range of £310 to £410 billion. Furlough payments of up to 80% of an employee's wages while the employees stayed home meant that companies went out of business as they were ordered to close while still paying their employees. When furlough ended, those employees were left with no income and no job. And there was a massive transfer of wealth as a result of the COVID hoax. And this is an article on Reuters.com. Pandemic boosts super rich share of global wealth. The share of household wealth owned by billionaires has risen by a record amount during the pandemic, with millionaires also coming out of COVID-19 ahead, a study found on Tuesday. Well, it was the response to a non-existent pandemic, but anyway, the article continues. The World Inequality Report, produced by a network of social scientists, estimated that billionaires this year, this is 2021, collectively own 3.5% of global household wealth, up from slightly above 2% at the start of the pandemic in early 2020. The COVID crisis has exacerbated inequalities between the very wealthy and rest of the population, lead author Lucas Chancel said, noting that rich economies used massive fiscal support to mitigate the sharp rises in poverty seen elsewhere. The report drew on a variety of specialist research and public domain data, with a foreword written by US-based economists Abhijit Banerjee and Esther Duflo, two of the trio who won a 2019 Nobel for work on poverty. The COVID crisis did not exacerbate inequalities. The response to a non-existent crisis did that. The article continues. Since wealth is a major source of future economic gains and increasingly of power and influence, this presages further increases in inequality. An extreme concentration of economic power in the hands of a very small minority of the super rich, they wrote. The findings corroborate a range of existing studies, rich lists and other evidence pointing to a rise in health, social, gender and racial inequalities during the pandemic. Forbes' annual World's Billionaires list included a record-breaking 2,755 billionaires with a combined worth of $13.1 trillion, up from $8 trillion in 2020. The new report showed that a wider group of 520,000 adults, who make up the top 0.01% richest together, saw their share of global wealth hit 11% in 2021, up from 10% in 2020. An article on the Times Online website reports that UK charity Beam found in a survey that the average Brit is only two paychecks away from homelessness. An article on business website QZ reports that across Western Europe and North America, the middle class is shrinking, and that with each new generation, a smaller share of the population find themselves earning middle incomes. According to a new report by the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, an intergovernmental organisation, the COVID hoax has massively destroyed businesses, employment and incomes worldwide, which is why it happened, but the cult are not finished yet. There are still people in the world who have a comfortable life money-wise. This is a problem for the cult who want everyone in dependency on authority for survival, thus under total control. When I say the cult want global poverty, I mean global poverty. A report by Oxfam in 2019 estimated that the world's richest 26 men owned as much as the poorest half of the global population, and none of them are in the inner core of the cult. Nearly 70 of the world's leading economic entities are cult-owned corporations, not countries. Apple historically became the world's first trillion-dollar company in 2018, and Bill Gates, massive cult gopher, Microsoft had a GDP larger than countries like Canada, Russia, and Spain. I described in the last episode a planned three-tier society in which the population are in desperation, destitution, and absolute poverty, where their only means of income and survival are guaranteed income, which is only allotted to your account if you allow the government to dictate the fine detail of your life. The plan is that an unelected technocratic world government will dictate the fine detail. The COVID virus that never existed was said to have come out of China, and we even had the claim, which some people fell for, that the virus came from a biolab in China. The idea that China, Russia, and Iran, long-time targets of the West, and provably so, decided to conspire together to post misinformation about Kate Middleton being absent from public view with no benefit to them is childlike beyond words. China, Russia, and Iran don't need to post misinformation about Kate Middleton's absence to destabilize the nation when the British government is doing that perfectly well on its own. The alternative media on the internet have been talking since at least the 1990s about the plan for a third world war, pitching the West against China, Russia, and Iran. What were the three countries that were said to be posting misinformation about Kate Middleton? China, Russia, and Iran. This is why, for a long time now, we've seen constant demonization of Russia and Putin, and this is starting to happen more now with China and Iran as well. The solution offered by authority after the war will be a world government and world army to stop it ever happening again, even though it was engineered into place by the West to start with. A classic technique of this cult is to create problems and then offer solutions. I heard an analogy for this recently. The solutions are the equivalent of Blue Peter. Here's one I made earlier. The solutions are already planned before the problems are created to justify the solution. The world government structure would be a global version of the European Union, except with no parliamentary debate. The plan is for an end to individual national sovereignty and an end to parliament. The agenda is that a one world government would dictate to every country. And if anyone thinks that couldn't happen, the World Health Organization have a legally binding pandemic treaty planned, which would dictate to member countries that sign up for it, which is most of the world. The pandemic treaty would mean that all the countries that sign up for it will be required by law to do what the World Health Organization says, to respond to a pandemic whenever they declare it. So there's no parliamentary debate, not that there was much of that during the COVID era anyway. and there's no chance of individual governments deciding what they're going to do in their country. They will have to do what the World Health Organization says they'll have to do. So protesting won't make any difference because the government won't be able to make any decisions anyway. Non-compliance with what the World Health Organization says will make a difference because that is always the answer. There's not enough people imposing and there's too many people
being imposed upon that if those people don't do what is being imposed upon them, then it cannot be enforced.
It's interesting that the Chinese model, the alternative media on the internet have been saying for decades that that is the blueprint, the model for the world dictatorship. And during the COVID era, which we're told came out of China, the COVID virus, the world, especially in the West, but elsewhere too, took on much more of a Chinese look and feel. So this is the article. Investment firms are often not acknowledged as a means of control, but they are fundamental in manipulating human society. BlackRock and Vanguard have shares and investments in every major sphere of business and commerce on Earth. It has been estimated in financial publications that by 2028, BlackRock and Vanguard will collectively manage around $20 trillion in investments worldwide. An Oxfam report showed that two-thirds of billionaire wealth is derived from inheritance, monopoly, and cronyism. Cronyism being, of course, when you appoint friends and associates to positions of authority. Or, you know, in this case, people who will follow the agenda. BlackRock lends money to cult-owned banks including Citibank, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase, as well as acting as a principal advisor. BlackRock also developed the computer program known as Aladdin that the banks use. BlackRock has hired many former government officials into senior roles. This means that BlackRock and Vanguard are in the hands of the richest people on Earth. BlackRock and Vanguard are owned by the cult, in other words. In this way, the cult owns every major sphere of business and commerce on Earth, as I've been pointing out for half my life now. More than that, BlackRock CEO Larry Fink said that BlackRock are forcing behaviours, and he's a big source of funding of woke, along with George Soros, another cult gopher, long-time cult gopher. So in other words, they're forcing the cult's agenda on the companies and corporations they own. If you add the similarly widespread presence, influence and power of the cult Zionist network, which I've talked about many times before, ultimately operating out of Israel, you can see how the cult's global influence, ownership and control of the world is not a theory but a demonstrable and verifiable fact. Anyone still find it hard to get their head around how the COVID hoax was pulled off? A major organization which has come to light since the COVID era, responsible for global climate policy, among other things, is the World Economic Forum, a major organization in the global cult network. The World Economic Forum is a think tank lobbying NGO headed by cult frontman Klaus Schwab, whose motto is "You will own nothing and you will be happy." NGOs are a major vehicle along with think tanks for advancing the agenda. Their think tanks are a means for the cult to propose the agenda under the guise of suggestion and policy recommendations. The World Economic Forum has partnered with cult-owned organizations like BlackRock, JP Morgan Chase and Google. In 2016, an article by Danish politician Ida Auken for Forbes.com later appeared on the World Economic Forum website, laying out the vision of the think tank. The article was written from the point of view of someone living in 2030, describing modern life, and 2030 is a year that keeps recurring all over the place. Key year for this agenda. The article is basically a promotional piece for the WEF cult agenda and talks about a service-based economy as opposed to owning products. The idea is that people order services and items when they need them without owning them. David de Rothschild has also proposed a service-based economy, which by definition means we don't need one, at least not in the way proposed by him or the World Economic Forum. The agenda is that services and items will be available for hire when needed, If you allow authority to dictate your life, dissidents of the system will be identifiable through 24/7 surveillance and denied access to the basics of life, and that includes food, water, and the ability to purchase. You will own nothing and be happy, and if you're not, tough. Orkin says in the article, "Once in a while, I get annoyed about the fact that I have no real privacy, nowhere I can go and not be registered. I know that somewhere everything I do, think, and dream is recorded. I just hope that nobody will use it against me." Well, the plan is that it will be used against you if what you do, and maybe even think, is challenging authority. In a speech at the Athens Democracy Forum in 2020, Yuval Noah Harari, he's a big salesperson for this agenda, along with Elon Musk, pointed to the COVID crisis hoax as the moment when everything became monitored and we agreed to be surveilled all the time. I must say, I don't remember giving my consent. Harari talked about hacking human beings. The body and brain can be hacked, he says, because they are computers, and that's correct, they are. Harari said the infotech revolution and discoveries in biological sciences would merge turning biological data into digital data analysed by computers. And, you know, we see the body as natural, technology as synthetic and technological, but the cult sees the body, it sees biology as technological. I mean, you had Moderna in their documents talk about the body and the COVID fake vaccine, which doesn't meet any previous criteria of a vaccine, as an operating system. Because the body is a computer and the cult sees it as a form of technology. Harari made a key point that COVID and other pandemics or fake pandemics can convince people to accept total biometric surveillance. We saw during the COVID era how far people will go to be what they think is protected. And that's why, one reason why, the COVID-19 pandemic was made up out of thin air in the first place. Harari said the same technology can determine what you think about authority. Harari talked about your TV watching you and analysing body language and biological cues from your body. Orwell's telescreens, anyone? Smart TVs, anyone? Dr. Richard Day, a pediatrician who gave a speech to a meeting of pediatricians, talked about smart TVs in 1969. And he said, this is a quote from someone who was quoting him, "You'll be watching television and somebody will be watching you at the same time at a central monitoring station. Television sets would have a device to enable this. The TV set would not have to be on in order for this to be operative. Also, the television set can be used to monitor what you're watching. People can tell what you're watching on TV and how you're reacting to what you're watching, and you would not know that you were being watched while you were watching your television. One thing the television would be used for would be purchases. You would not have to leave your home to purchase. You just turn on your TV and there would be a way of interacting with your television channel to the store that you wanted to purchase, and you could flip the switch from place to choose a refrigerator or clothing." He's talking about the internet in 1969 because, as I've said many times before, the technological disparity is such that technology that we would think of as impossible to exist now exists now. What we see is light years behind what we don't see. Monitoring is only one step away from manipulating. Surveillance of humanity is operating on a level far beyond many people's comprehension. Science magazine reported in March 2023 that AI can now read brain scans and recreate highly realistic versions of images a person has seen. Researchers say possible implications of this technology could include aiding communication in people with paralysis, exploring how various animal species perceive the world, and perhaps one day recording human dreams. Remember the Ida Orkin statement I read out earlier? The technology uses AI algorithms known as stable diffusion and text descriptions to generate the images. AI has been utilized in many laboratories, but this is the first time an AI algorithm has been employed to this end. We're seeing AI taking over more and more, and of course this situation with Kate Middleton, some people are saying the video of her on the bench talking about cancer is at least partly, if not completely, an AI deep fake. And the technology has existed in the public arena for long enough now to be able to do that. So beyond the public arena, they've got technology where you absolutely won't be able to tell whether something is AI or real. And we're getting to that point in the public arena more and more as the technology is just released in a ever quicker fashion now, because it's got to a point now where more it's conceivable that more advanced technology could exist. So it's being rolled out quicker and quicker. The technology that's existed for generations that's just been sitting there waiting to be rolled out. It couldn't be rolled out too quickly, or people would ask where it came from and how technology has advanced that quickly. So the cult and the real inner core levels of the military intelligence agencies had to await for a point where it was conceivable that this technology could exist before letting the public see it and use it. And that's why this agenda has not been anywhere close to being completed yet, because they had to wait for the point when they could roll out the technology that they need to complete their agenda. This is why they didn't complete their agenda in the 1500s or the 1600s, for example, because they couldn't roll out the technology then, because it was just too, there was too much of a disparity between what was available then in terms of technology, basically nothing, and what actually existed. So, and how there can be that scale of a disparity, and much wider in truth, I explain in my book, Reality Check. So, a group in Japan, they used this stable diffusion system that I mentioned just now. By this, they did it by linking additional text descriptions about thousands of photos to brain patterns elicited when those photos were observed by participants in brain scan studies. Yu Takagi, a systems neuroscientist at Osaka University, who worked on the experiment, explains that the AI algorithm analyzes information gathered from different regions of the brain involved in image perception, such as the occipital and temporal lobes. The system interpreted information from functional MRI brain scans, which detect changes in blood flow to active regions of the brain. When people look at a photo, the temporal lobes predominantly register information about the contents of the image, people, objects, or scenery, whereas the occipital lobe predominantly registers information about the layout and perspective, such as the scale and position of the contents. All of this information is recorded by MRIs. It captures peaks in brain activity, and these patterns can then be reconverted into an imitation image using AI. Shinji Nishimoto, another systems neuroscientist at Osaka University who worked on the study, hopes that with further refinements, the technology could be used to intercept imagined thoughts and dreams, or could allow scientists to understand how differently other animals perceive reality. Technology utilizing electromagnetic waves, like Wi-Fi, sending a low-powered signal through a wall, which reverberates around the room, can detect all the objects in the room, cancel out the static objects, and when the signal bounces back, use the reflection of moving objects to generate a radar-like image. This technology can work through standard drywall, wooden fences, and even concrete walls. Researchers at Carnegie Mellon University have said that Wi-Fi signals, electromagnetic waves, can serve as a ubiquitous substitute for regular cameras in terms of sensing people in a room. Using Wi-Fi, they wrote, overcomes obstacles like poor lighting that regular camera lenses face. They say this technology may be used to monitor the well-being of older people or identify suspicious behaviours at home. The plan is to deny access to the basis of survival to anyone challenging or exposing authority. The Ida Orkin article says, once in a while, I will choose to cook for myself. It is easy. The necessary kitchen equipment is delivered at my door within minutes. And we're now seeing, of course, the introduction of 15-minute cities in which everything you need is available within 15 minutes, thus negating the need for travel, even if you're allowed to travel. And, you know, I've talked for a long time about the plan to end private travel. Public transport will only be allowed to those who allow the government to dictate their life. People will be fined automatically The money will come out of their bank account if they leave their 15-minute city without permission. This is one of the reasons for a central bank digital currency, a cashless society, total control. And of course, it stops people coming together in numbers because, you know, if you're only allowed to travel a certain distance, you can't come together. The Ida Orkin article concludes with this statement. All in all, it is a good life, much better than the path we're on, where it became so clear that we could not continue with the same model of growth. We had all these terrible things happening. Lifestyle diseases, climate change, the refugee crisis, environmental degradation, completely congested cities, water pollution, air pollution, social unrest, and unemployment. We lost way too many people before we realized that we could do things differently. The social welfare program is nothing more than an open-ended credit balance system which creates a false capital industry to give non-productive people a roof over their heads and food in their stomachs. This can be useful, however, because the recipients become state property in return for the gift, a standing army for the elite, for he who pays the piper picks the tune. And, you know, those terrible things that were listed, let's have a look at them. Lifestyle diseases, I detail in Reality Check. And, you know, there's a lot of great sources for this. Dr. Tom Cowan, Dr. Andrew Kaufman, Sam and Mark Bailey. There's also the website virology.com, V-I-R-O-L-I-E-G-Y.com, which looks at the idea that viruses don't exist. There's an enormous amount of information and evidence for this. And contagion is a myth. The idea that you can pass on germs to other people. And bacteria and microorganisms don't cause disease. On top of all that, and Dr. Richard Day talked about this, the guy I mentioned just now who gave that speech in 1969. He said then, because he was close to the Rockefellers, through being an executive of a Rockefeller organization called Planned Parenthood, which is a eugenics organization. He said the Rockefeller Institute has the cure for cancer, and that was 1969, all cancers. And there are other diseases for which the cures and treatments are available, but the public are told they're not. Diseases are not what we're told. Climate change, well, that's not caused by humans anyway, that's a myth. As I've detailed in my first book, Pay-Per-View in Print, which is going to have a second edition very soon. The refugee crisis, well, that's being manipulated into place to change the demographics and the culture of especially Western society, but not only. Also, North America and other places. Environmental degradation, well, it's ironic that the cult, through its corporations and front people, are destroying the environment while claiming to care about the environment to sell the climate change hoax or their responses to it. Completely congested cities. The more migration there is, the more that will happen. Water pollution, air pollution. Well, if the coal-owned corporations stopped polluting, that would help. Social unrest, which is being manipulated and engineered into place, not least by destroying the economy and playing hoaxes like climate change and the extent of climate change. Yes, the climate is changing. The extent of it and the cause of it is what I question. I've said to many people. And the more you destroy the economy and the ability of people to earn a living through hoaxes like the human-caused climate change hoax and the response to that and the cost of responding to it and also the COVID hoax, for example, among other means, the more there will be social unrest and unemployment. Well, again, same answer to that. So these are all manipulated into place, all these terrible things, so that the solution to that, well, there's other reasons as well, to destroy the health of the population and make people more controllable, but another reason is they're manipulated into place so that the solution can be offered which suits the agenda of the cult. Destroying society and then use the example of the destruction of society to justify what you want. And this agenda goes back a very, very, very long way. And it's projected forward much, much longer than people would think. The cult has now reached the point in the unfolding of their agenda where it's becoming more obvious because they can't hide it any longer. At some point, society, indeed global society, has to start to transform in the image of that agenda. Otherwise, they've not changed society. It stayed the same. So for it to change, it has to get to a point where you can see it. And that's where we are now. And that's why so many people are starting to see this now. So they've moved from hiding it to sales pitching it. This is why they couldn't see it in the 80s, 70s, 60s, 50s, 1800s, for example. A, because the information wasn't available, but it wasn't available because it was much more hidden. And, you know, I've been asked before if this is meant to be a secret agenda. How come I know about it and lots of people know about it around the world? Because it's becoming more obvious. They're having to put it on public display because they have to sales pitch it because they can't deny it's happening. So they need to explain away why it's happening and sell it as a good thing. And that's what organizations like the World Economic Forum are there for. And Elon Musk and Yuval Harari and all these people. They're sales pitchers. They're not the origin, they're the sales pitcher. And if they weren't doing it, other people would be. The plan is for total control, and this is why the cult and government is targeting the means of survival. So what can we do? For a start, we can refuse smart meters and insist on keeping cash circulating. If you're running a business, you can refuse to play a part in the AI takeover. If the cult through government try to play another pandemic hoax again, and you run a business, you can keep your business open despite all the pressure to close it. There's lots of things we can do. It's just a case of making the choice to do them.
So that's it for this week. That's the news. That's the contest and connections. That's pay-per-view. More to come next week. Until then, goodbye.